I call this meeting of the House Higher Education Finance and Policy Committee to order. Members, before we jump into the agenda for today, it is my great pleasure to welcome back to the committee our fearless co-chair, Representative Marian Rarick. Co-chair Rarick, we're honored to have you back. We just know how much we've been missing you and thinking about you and holding you in our hearts. It has not been, by far, has not been the same committee without your passion and your expertise here. And so we're just very, very grateful to see you back here with us. And I'd like to turn it over to Representative Robbins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Chair Rarick, for joining us. We're glad to see you back, and we look forward to your participation and guidance, as always. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Members, please join me in giving a round of applause for Co-Chair Rarick. Welcome back. All right. The first item on the agenda is the approval of the minutes. Representative Novotny, have you had the opportunity to approve the minutes for March 10th, 2026?
I have not. And after Tuesday's meeting, I would defer to someone that actually has read it.
Fair enough. All right. Vice Chair Coulter, have you had the opportunity to review the minutes for March 10th, 2026?
I have, Mr. Chair, and I will move their approval.
Vice Chair Coulter moves the approval of the minutes for our March 10th, 2026 committee hearing. Members, is there any discussion to the motion? Hearing none. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, please say no. The motion prevails, and the minutes for March 10th, 2026 are approved. All right, members, just a little roadmap for today. We have two bills before us. The first bill that we will call up is House File 3432, Representative Rehrauer, resident tuition rates provided to individuals who move to Minnesota for employment purposes. While the representative gets up to the table, I will move that House File 3432 be laid over. We would like to move this, but as we talked about on Tuesday, we don't want to move anything until it has a fiscal note, and we do not yet have a fiscal note. We will keep members updated on that status. So for now, we're going to lay it over. All right. Representative Rehrauer, I know that you have an author's amendment, but before we get into that, I would like for you to present your bill, and then we'll get into the author's amendment. Representative Rehrauer.
Okay. Thank you so much, Mr. Chair. Thank you, members of the committee, for hearing the bill. This bill comes from a constituent of mine in Coon Rapids. Their entire family moved from Texas to Minnesota to relocate permanently. The mom is currently working here full-time, and yet their daughter cannot get resident tuition rates and must put off going to college for a full year. So House File 3432 remedies this problem by allowing resident tuition rates for individuals who moved to the state for employment purposes. So before moving and before applying for admission to public post-secondary institution, they accepted a full-time job in the state, or their spouse accepted a full-time job, or they're the dependent of a person who accepted the full-time job. So it works for this family because the mom is already working full-time before applying. With the labor shortage we have, I think this is a simple and great way to encourage a few more families to move to Minnesota. I have met with both Minnesota State and the University of Minnesota. In meeting with them, we did do some modifications. We changed the effective date upon their request to be pushed back until next fall. And we added a section to make it clear that this is the minimum requirement, because sometimes they do make exceptions with some broader reasons. So both institutions are good with the bill as it is now.
All righty. Thank you very much for that introduction. Members, Representative Rehrauer has an author's amendment labeled A2. I will move that the author's amendment to be put on the bill so that we can get the bill in the shape that the author so desires. Does everyone have a copy of the amendment? All righty. Representative Rehrauer, please proceed with briefly telling us what this amendment does.
Okay. Thank you. So this bill amends the statute regarding resident tuition rates. But a different statute would then have made it so that any student who qualifies for the resident tuition rates would also end up qualifying for as a resident student for the purposes of financial aid. And this was not my original intent of the bill. So the author's amendment is going to clarify this will only apply to the tuition rates and not state financial aid. I hope that we can possibly add this and do it in the future. But as of now, our state financial aid programs are already under strain, including the state grant program, as we know. So it doesn't make sense to do that at this time.
Thank you, members. Is there any discussion to the A2 amendment? Representative Robbins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Breyer. Could you just explain again, because where I see that amendment, it just says it's taking beginning of fall 2027 and deleting the rest of that paragraph in the original bill. So is that where it had talked about applying to financial aid programs?
I think
Representative Rehrauer.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. I would like to have research explained a little bit more deeply because they found the reason how this statute would affect another statute.
Thank you.
Mr. Hawkins.
Mr. Chair, Representative Robbins, so the A2 amendment is inserting a new section in the bill. It's not deleting anything in the existing bill. It inserts a new section, and what that section does is it amends the definition of resident student that's used for state financial aid purposes. And on line 2.4 of the A2 amendment, you can see that it limits eligibility for state financial aid under that resident tuition statute that's being amended in the bill so that state financial aid, it only applies for the students that meet the existing criteria under 135A.043, the resident tuition statute. So it's not going to include the new language that's added by House File 3432. So the students that are qualifying for resident tuition under House File 3432 do not automatically qualify for state financial aid under the definition of resident student that's used by the Office of Higher Education.
Representative Robbins.
Thank you, Mr. Hopkins. And just to clarify then, is the language in the original bill 2.6 to 2.10 still existing?
Mr. Hopkins.
Mr. Chair, Representative Robbins, yes, you see that the A2 amendment inserts this new language after page 2, line 10. So it's just at the very end of the House File 3432.
Representative Robbins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And so to be clear, the underlying bill applies this new language for qualifying for in-state tuition to currently enrolled students who previously were enrolled at non-state, out-of-state rates.
Mr. Hopkins.
Mr. Chair, Representative Robbins, yes. So the effective date for the underlying bill applies it to, it's effective beginning in fall 2027 academic term and applies to all eligible currently enrolled students. Mm-hmm. So if a student wasn't eligible for resident tuition rates and would be under the bill beginning in fall 2027, they're eligible for the resident student tuition, resident tuition rate.
Representative Robbins.
Thank you. I just wanted to make sure I was understanding. Thank you.
All right. Any further discussion to the A2 author's amendment? Representative Cleborn.
Thank you. I just want to clarify the last answer to make sure I have it right. So the intent of the bill as amended would be if a family were moving to Minnesota for a parent's or for employment, then it may or may not be an existing student, correct? Or would it only apply to students who are moving into the state? So let's say, for example, I have a child, I live in Missouri, I send my child to the University of Minnesota, and they're currently paying out-of-state tuition. My family moves to Minnesota for employment, Would I then be able to claim in-state tuition because my family is now resident of the state for employment purposes? That's scenario one.
So.
Scenario two is I have children who are in-state in Missouri because we are living in Missouri as in-state, and now we are moving to Minnesota. My student wants to move to Minnesota with me, so they now become a transfer in-state student.
Okay.
Does that make sense?
Yeah.
So I have it right?
To me.
Representative Rehauer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I believe that it would, and I would want it to, because in both cases we have other family members moving for employment with our labor shortage. That would be a benefit. But I will ask Mr. Hopkins if he could clarify for sure if that would work with this current language or not.
Mr. Hopkins.
Mr. Chair, members, so under the language in House File 3432, the full-time job needs to have been accepted before the student moves to and applies for admission to the public post-secondary institution. So if the employment comes after the application to the institution, it doesn't count. But if the employment comes before you've applied to the institution, then it does count.
Okay. Thank you for that clarification. That's what I was looking for.
All righty. Thank you, Representative Cleavorn. Members, are there any further questions or discussion to the A2 author's amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor of adopting the A2 author's amendment, please signify by saying aye. Those opposed, please say no. The motion prevails and the A2 amendment is adopted. Members, we have another amendment in our packets labeled A1. Does everyone have a copy of the A1 amendment? And I believe, Representative Robbins, that you are authoring this amendment. Is that correct?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
All righty. Representative Robbins, if you would please explain the A1 amendment.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. So, members, the language of the underlying bill says that it's for once someone has accepted a full-time job in the state or is the spouse or dependent of a person meeting this requirement. Mm-hmm. And my amendment would just insert, after that statement, a valid employment pay stub must be required in order to verify eligibility under this clause. And the purpose is that when someone has accepted a full-time job, we don't really have documentation of that, and we found in the fraud committee that there are a lot of things in our statutes that just rely on attestation, and that is not sufficient. And so because this is about people getting access to the reduced in-state tuition rate, I want to make sure that there's actually documentation of the employment that is being used as the reason for why they qualify.
Thank you, Representative Robbins. Representative Rehauer, and then Representative Hicks is on the list, but would you care to explain your position on the A1 amendment?
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Robbins, for bringing forward a friendly amendment. I, as the author of the bill, would be gladly willing to accept that amendment. We absolutely want to do everything we can to prevent fraud. I would want to check with MnState. I believe there is a representative here today just to find out if that is something they would be able to do with their processes.
Does there happen to be a representative from MnState in the hearing today? Mr. Roman, welcome back to the House Higher Education Committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Chair Wilgamont. Chair Rarick, good to see you. Representative reached out to us fairly, very early on when she developed the bill. We had a couple of meetings with her, and she took our considerations into account when she put the bill together. But for us, this bill doesn't have any effect whatsoever. You know, obviously, Minnesota State is your community colleges, your regional comprehensives, and with the reciprocity agreements with some of the surrounding states, we just don't have a lot of out-of-state out-of-state students other than probably those that are involved in athletics, which is a whole different subject. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Oman. Further discussion to the A1 amendment, Representative Hicks.
Thank you so much. And I appreciate wanting some documentation, but as the Rochesterite who brings in a whole bunch of people for employment at Mayo, could we consider a job offer letter? So like when you're applying to a mortgage and you're moving states, you can use a job offer letter to show qualification. And because my community particularly attracts so many high wage earners in research and in physicians, they many times have a job offer letter, but it may be a longer process to get here to actually start that work, because they're many times wrapping up research in other spaces and things like that. And I would hate if they were moving here and had a few weeks and school already started and then they didn't have a pay stub yet. Since mortgage companies use job offer letters, would we be open to, since we're laying it over, maybe tweaking the language to a pay stub or a, you know, certified job offer letter or something? Just a thought.
Representative Robbins.
Thank you, Representative Hicks, and I'm happy to work with you and Representative Rehrauer on like what the best solution is, but some sort of documentation is what I'm seeking. Thank you.
Is there any further discussion to the A1 amendment authored by Representative Robbins? Chair Rarick.
Thank you, Chair Wolgamott. Just really quickly, as have been on the FROG committee for a long time, I think this is absolutely essential for this to work. And then I also have a question that Mr. Oman kind of raised, and I don't have this at the top of my head, but which states do we have reciprocity with? So we can kind of get a scope as to which states might be impacted as people move from them.
Mr. Oman, would you care to answer?
Chair Wolgamott, Bernie Oman, Minnesota State. My understanding is we currently have reciprocity agreements. I'm looking to my friends at the House of Higher Education with North Dakota and Wisconsin. I think South Dakota went a different direction, and Iowa went to, you know, but you know, our border states that our campuses are close to anyway are in, especially Wisconsin and North Dakota.
All right, thank you, Representative Rarick.
Thank you. So the border state. So I believe he said South Dakota is not one, but so the three surrounding us. But I would say, you know, if we're opening this up, it's much wider than that. That's only three states. Mm-hmm. So we can have more discussion when we get to the underlying bill.
Thank you. Any further discussion to the Robbins A1 amendment? Hearing none, all those in favor of adopting the A1 amendment, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, please say no. The motion prevails and the A1 amendment is adopted. All righty, now we are on the underlying bill, House File 3432, as amended. Is there any public testimony for House File 3432? All right, hearing none, we will now move on to member discussion. Members, do you have any further questions or discussion topics for House File 3432? I recognize Representative Robbins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Rehrauer, forgive me for always missaying it. I try. How, can you say it, Tori?
Is that okay?
Yes, go ahead.
It's Rehrauer.
Rehrauer, that's very helpful. I'm sorry. So my understanding is that students qualified for resident tuition if they attended a high school in Minnesota for 3 years and graduated from a Minnesota high school. And the new definition in the amendment for a resident student is substantially expanding that. So I just wondered if you could address, to me, this seems like a giant policy change. So I wondered if you could address that.
Representative Rehrauer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would just defer back to Minn State, the conversations I had with them and both the U of M. They felt like it would affect a relatively small number of individuals and families, and they were both happy with or neutral or satisfied with this bill as it was with those changes that they had requested of moving the effective date so that it wouldn't affect enrollment this fall, and also stating it's a minimum requirement because sometimes they do offer in-state tuition rates for some broader reasons. So with both of those feeling that it wasn't, you know, opening the door too wide, I feel comfortable with the bill as written.
Okay. Representative Robbins.
Thank you.
Further discussion to House File 3432. I recognize Representative Novotny.
Thank you, Chair. Welcome on. Representative Rehrauer, why should individuals in this state who have been paying our taxes and supporting these institutions now extend that to someone from a state that hasn't been paying the freight like we have?
Representative Rehrauer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We do have a very large labor shortage, and we know it's not going to get better over the next couple of decades. It's going to continue to get worse as our older population continues to grow and our workforce population relative to the older population is continuing to get smaller. So we really do want to encourage more folks to move here permanently, and that is also why it's for employment, because once they are here for employment, they will be paying Minnesota taxes also, which will be a benefit to the state. And if they're coming here for full-time employment, we are hoping and encouraging them to stay.
Representative Novotny.
Thank you, Chair Wolgamott. Representative Rehrauer, then how short are we? How short are we on labor and overall? How many people are you hoping to bring in on this?
Representative Rehrauer.
Yeah, this is just going to be one small piece of the puzzle. This will not solve the labor shortage alone. We're going to need to attract more folks in more different ways than just that. But I think that, you know, when you have a bill and it can't fully solve a problem, but it helps a little bit, I don't think that not fully solving the bigger problem is a reason not to accept the bill if it helps a little bit. I think we can also hope to bring forward other bills in this committee and on other committees that will also help with the labor shortage. And that would be a priority for me as a legislator.
Representative Novotny.
Thank you, Chair Wolgamott. Representative Rehrauer, then, have you evaluated the shift? How many students are you thinking that this would bring into the Minnesota system?
Representative Rehrauer.
Representative Notney, I think that's a great question. I do not have a specific number for you. I can, though, however, reach out to the U of M and get back to you on that. And I don't know if MinState, well, you know, they're in a different situation where they already have those, you know, moderate to low tuition rates for all students. So I think it's really the U of M that I can reach out to, and I can personally get back to you on that.
Representative Votney, I'd also just note that we're still waiting to get a fiscal note, but that might have some more answers to your questions there.
Well, believe me,
Representative Votney.
I was going to touch on that, Chair Wolgamott. Thank you, because I thought we didn't hear bills in this committee that didn't have fiscal notes ready, because it is really important to have some estimate of what it's going to bring in and how many students are we talking about. Are we attempting to solve a problem of labor shortage? Are we trying to get more kids into the schools? I don't know how many kids we are short. What is the capacity of the Minnesota schools that this would affect that we're trying to hope? Do we need 5,000, 6,000, 10,000 kids to get to capacity? Do you know that?
Representative Votney, I'd like to just add that we don't move bills in this committee without a fiscal note. We have on multiple occasions heard bills in this committee without a fiscal note. We just don't move them. Representative Rehrauer.
Was the concern over how many students might be coming? And I would just reassure you again that I had, as you heard from our representative from MinState, multiple conversations, follow-up emails with both of our institutions to discuss this matter. Both were very comfortable with the bill and with how many students they felt that it would attract. And so because they're comfortable, I'm comfortable with that.
Representative Novotny.
One more question. Thank you, Chair Wolgamott. Almost did it again. Chair Wolgamott, thank you. Just like to point out, I did some looking up of statistics. And thank God I can still look it up for the numbers because the law was changed in 2023, so I can tell you what this was. But if we go to 2008 and we look at the birth rates for 2008, and the Minnesota Department of Health was still able to post numbers because we still cared enough to record the numbers back in 2008, but the law was changed in 2023, so I wouldn't be able to tell you this in 18 years when they're having this meeting and this thing discussing the problems that were shortage. But I looked up the numbers. Department of Health reported that in 2008, which would be probably our next class coming into college, there was reported 12,948 abortions in the state of Minnesota. So maybe we could solve that by not having to import people if we didn't have full-time abortion. And I suspect that'll be my last question.
All right. Further discussion. Representative Cleavorn.
Thank you. Well, I'm going to take this conversation a little bit in a different direction. So I want to thank you for being interested in how we can recruit people to our state with this potential enticement, right? Mm-hmm. We know that with the baby boomers retiring at a very fast rate and our state aging, that we have about 158,000 jobs that we need to have filled right away. And we have lost a great deal of our brain trust to retirement, and we will need to have those highly skilled individuals. And right now, according to the current labor statistics I was able to find, we have about 83 workers for every 100 jobs. So whether it's the really high-tech agricultural jobs that we have today, or if it's in healthcare, this is an incentive that I think is attractive. Now, on a personal note, having moved my family, not just around the United States, but also internationally, it's really important that we know that wherever we land, we are able to get our students into the right educational institution for them, whatever stage of life that they're in. And I can assure people around this table that when you have people who are moving for those high level positions, they more than make up for the tax cost that the institution or the state is incurring by allowing in-state tuition over their tax base is usually very healthy. And so I'm happy to give that. And I'm very glad that we're talking about the importance of data in this committee, because the Trump administration has decimated important data on health, on climate, on sustainability, on women's economics. So I'm 100% behind you. Let's keep all the data possible. So thank you so much. That's all I have to say.
Further discussion to House File 3432. I recognize Representative Allen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to first off thank you for bringing this forward. It's something to be considered and looked at. Thank you for taking the amendment as far as having a valid employment's pay stub. The only thing I'm concerned about is, you know, seeing everything that's happened in the state, there's always loopholes, there's always something that falls between the cracks as far as verification whether or not people stay here or not. And I see kind of a major loophole potentially in just having them only verify that they paid here once. Could you tell me, Representative Ray Rauer, with the amendment, is there anything tying an a family to staying here in Minnesota? Let's say there's a parent that ends up coming up here, gets a job at a quick trip at McDonald's or something temporarily, gets one pay stub and turns around and they decide to go back home and let their child finish their 4 years here in the state of Minnesota.
Representative Ray Rauer.
Thank you, Representative Allen. I appreciate the question. I think that what would be tying folks to Minnesota is our beautiful lakes, our beautiful parks and trails, our safe cities, our fabulous education that we have, our you know, just everything that I love about the state and everything that other folks love about the state. And the goal is to attract them. And, you know, once they have that full-time employment and they're here, I feel confident they'll stay. And I'm happy to have them.
Representative Allen.
I appreciate that, Mr. Chair, and for indulging my question on this. I do agree with you, Representative Ray Rauer, that we do have a lot of great amenities here in the state of Minnesota, but it didn't answer the question. And that's the concern I have about that in terms of the loophole that's potentially there. To Representative Cleavorn's point, it's, you know, once individuals are here, they're paying into the system, and it's just kind of helps with being able to help with filling the money that we need in order to be able to run the grants and everything that we have here in the state of Minnesota. And that is probably my biggest concern about it, because we already know that we're staring at a budgetary shortfall specifically in these programs. And yeah, I just don't want to create more of an issue by bringing kids in that would qualify for like the Minnesota grant or the North Star Promise or something along those lines. So thank you.
Further discussion, Representative Ray Rauer, if you'd like to respond.
I just want to answer that last point made. So budgetary concerns, that's why we added the amendment. They will not be eligible for the financial aid. The amendment takes care of that. And then the hope of, you know, and potential, and it would be up to this committee that in the future, if those funds are there and we could add those folks, it'd be something to consider, but at this time it would not include the financial aid.
Representative Allen.
I appreciate the clarification. Thank you.
All right, further discussion to House File 3432, Representative Rearick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I didn't hear anything in this entire conversation about the private colleges. Are the private colleges included? And if so, have you had conversations with them? Because they have, their systems are very different. Their schools are very different than the University of Minnesota and very different than Minn State. So I'm just wondering what's happened in that area.
Representative Ray Rauer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think the biggest concern would have been with that state grant program already being underfunded as of now, and that is why we added the amendment so that none of that money that is often for our private college students in a way that helps them attend school there, we want to make sure that we're not taking from that. As far as resident tuition rates, no, we did not include that in this bill. I haven't heard interest from private colleges in doing that and opening that up, but I would be happy to have that discussion and have a future bill if they were.
Representative Rearick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I've been around for a while. This is my 14th year, and I've spent most of those years on the Higher Ed Committee, and I've been through all kinds of iterations at the University of Minnesota. And I remember many years ago, several presidents ago, where the University of Minnesota had very low outstate tuition, and so non-residential tuition. And it was problematic because it put so much pressure on the in-state tuition, and it puts a great deal of pressure. So I don't know if the current University of Minnesota folks remember that, but I certainly have lived through that. So we are cost shifting. Even if you're not taking money out of the state grant program, but it sounds like you want to, which is also problematic because it's already $102 million projected shortfall. And we just, it was about $222 million, I believe, of the expenditures just in 1 year. So that's a pretty substantial hole that we're gonna have to fix. And for me, that's my number one priority, is actually fixing the structural issues that we've created in the state grant program. So while you may not be taking money from the state grant program, you certainly are cost shifting. I've seen it, I've lived through it, and we encouraged the University of Minnesota at that time to actually raise non-resident tuition, non-in-state tuition, so that it would take the burden off of Minnesotans. And now we're going the other direction again. And maybe it's a little bit smaller than the issue that we dealt with at the University of Minnesota, but it certainly is going in the wrong direction. We have got big issues here in the Higher Ed Committee. We've got a very big shortfall that we're projecting, and we've created a structural deficit going forward by many changes that were done, including North Star Promise. So I'm glad we're laying this over, because I see a lot of problems, and the reason I see them is because I've been here long enough to see where we've been, what we changed, and where we're headed. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Rarick. Further member discussion, Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Ray Rauer, thanks for bringing the bill on behalf of your constituent. We all like doing that when we have a constituent that comes to us with an issue. My first question would be, wouldn't you think before a person moves here, if they have a college-age student, wouldn't they consider the fact that if they're going to be moving to another state that maybe they're not going to get in-state tuition? Wouldn't that be a consideration in the decision that they've made to move here?
Representative Ray Rauer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think that absolutely could be a consideration. The goal of this is to attract families to move here together for employment purposes. And if I could just take a minute to address what Chair Rarick said on the so I just want to make it clear, I do not advocate taking money out of the state grant program. I made that clear. We added the amendment specifically for this purpose when we found out that it could potentially have an effect on financial aid situation and the state grant program. I said if in the future that was, you know, we had a completely different situation financially and we had extra funding, or which, you know, may never happen, but is very much an if, then we could consider, and this committee again would have a vote on that and would be able to vote it down. So just want to make that clear. This also does not change the out-of-state tuition. It only changes the resident rate for those folks that come here for full-time employment.
Thank you, Representative Ray Rauer. Representative Scott, anything further?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, yes. So have you, your constituents moved here from Texas. Do we have a similar arrangement with Texas? So if our students move down there, are they going to get the same treatment? Are their states going to offer our students this treatment?
Representative Ray Rauer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. No, not that I'm aware of, but what we want is more families to move here. We don't want our families to move to Texas.
We'd like to compete with Texas for those employees. Representative Scott.
Yeah, well, thank you for saying that, because the fact of the matter is, if you look at the outward migration to the state of Minnesota in the past few years, there have been floods of people leaving the state. And do you know why? Because it's an unfriendly tax environment. The Democrats have squandered an $18 billion surplus. They raised taxes $10 billion, $9 billion. And then we have $9 billion worth of fraud. People are leaving this state. So I understand why you want more people to be attracted to this state. But I would hope that maybe, you know, some of the families that have moved to Texas and Florida and other places out of the state of Minnesota and into these friendlier states, I hope that they're asking for the same privilege in those other states, so that when they move to those states, that their kids get in-state tuition too. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Anything in response to that, Representative Rarick? Okay, great. All right, moving on to further member discussion, Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Chair. My family's been in this country for hundreds, or the state, I should say, for hundreds of years, and so I'm kind of sad to hear about this kind of vibe of not being the welcoming, warm, Minnesota nice energy that we want. Sometimes I worry that when we are so averse to this sort of thing and welcoming more people to our state, it's sometimes it's the kind of people that I think that people are not wanting to welcome that tend to be attracted to our state. People that want to live in a state where we are welcoming of all people, no matter who they are, who they love, what gender they identify as, what religion they practice or don't. You know, and so I'm always really sad when I kind of hear these trends throughout the state in the last couple of years. And so I hope we can work together to reinstill that. And I think this bill is a way to do that, to tell people we want to bring more people here. We want them to be to come to Minnesota and to feel welcome, because that is who we are. So for whoever is listening out there and thinking about coming to Minnesota and wants to come here to go to college or move here for a job, I just wanted on the record that they also hear us saying we do welcome you, and you are welcome here to be a part of our community, and you'll love it. It's great. I think we also need to be honest that we're going to have bigger issues in this committee if enrollment is down. We have been talking over and over about this enrollment crisis and making sure that we have more students in our programs. And so, you know, if we're not attracting more students to our programs, or if we are encouraging to not attract more students, or if we are encouraging to perpetuate an enrollment downward trend, rather than working to increase enrollment, I don't think that's the prerogative of this committee either, or the institutions that rely on us to have those conversations. So I think this bill also achieves what is intended to be one of the goals of this committee, which is to increase enrollment, encourage people to attend our schools here, encourage people to stay in state. Hopefully it's cheaper for them that if they go than going out of state. But I do think that the biggest loss is if we forget who we are as Minnesotans, which is a welcoming community of all people, regardless of what it is. And this is a small way to say that they're welcome here. And I think the comments with the privates, there's not many that have a different rate as far as I'm aware. Generally, the privates offer us the same or similar rate for in-state versus out-of-state as far as I'm aware. So I just wanted to get that out there and answer that question too. And I will support you if you want to help, you know, work on extending this and make sure we're including folks after they accept the job. I think doing this before they accept the job requires a lot of planning. And sometimes, like Representative Hicks said, these jobs aren't always things that you can plan for. Sometimes you get transferred, you know, and I'm thinking of like military families. I'm thinking of a lot of people who get transferred here, maybe because they didn't choose that. And so I do think there's other scenarios where we can ensure that we are having big wide open arms for people who are coming here. And I do not think that that is a negative or a bad thing to be welcoming of people, especially people who are coming here to contribute to society, to gain an education. We know that a higher education is a great protective factor for a whole lot of things for generations. Higher education is not just a protective factor for us who go to school, the student. It is for our children, our grandchildren, our great-grandchildren, our friends, our neighbors, our communities, the places we work. It is a ripple effect. Higher education is important. And in a time when we are seeing some national conversations about kind of watering down the value, talking about which kinds of degrees or educations are worthy or not, and the trends that we see in what careers that are set as worthy or not, and the trends that how that tracks with genders that tend to work in each of those roles, right? So women's jobs being told that they're, or jobs that women work a lot being told that they're less valuable. Like, these are real conversations happening on the national level. So I think it's important to welcome people like this. I think it's important, not just for this generation, but for future ones of our families and our institutions and this institution, so that we can continue to educate the public, which is something I think all governing bodies should take a really serious responsibility in. So thank you.
Thank you for that, Representative Hansen. Next up on the list for member discussion is Representative Schwartz.
Thank you, Chair. Representative Rayer, I just have more along of a statement here for you. I just have some concerns about the bill. You said this bill is intended to help with the state's workforce gap. However, I am just, yeah, but there's no requirements for anyone to stay after they're getting their degree to even contribute to the economy and the workforce. I just am not confident that the bill will do what you're hoping that it will do. Thank you.
Further member discussion, Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Rewar, I thank you for thinking about these issues and bringing a bill to the committee. And sorry, I'm going to be just a bit off your topic because I just wanted to respond briefly to Representative Novotny's comments. I think inherent in his statement relating to abortion is the value in there that somehow people having the right to decide whether to bear a child isn't somehow valid, and that women are actually factories to produce workers. And I really reject that idea that they should be forced to carry pregnancy so that we can have more workers in Minnesota. I also do want to say that it isn't accurate to say that we ended reporting on abortions. We did not. The reports are online. And in fact, I don't know why the year 2008 was chosen. I haven't been able to pull that all up in the short time here, but the number of abortions has been dropping over time, actually.
Mr. Chair.
So I do think that...
Point of order, Mr. Chair.
Representative Novotny, please state your point of order.
My point of order was my question that I had and the comment that I made was directly relating to the bill and the fact that we, and in response to questions that Representative Rehauer had.
Point of order, Chair.
I don't know if we're here point to order, rehash.
Hold on, Representative Hansen. Let's let Representative Novotny finish his point of order and we'll get on to yours. Representative Novotny.
My comment and question was directly related to the issue of the bill. And I would appreciate it if the comments would be restricted to the language and the issues of 3432.
Thank you, Representative Novotny. Representative Hansen, to your point of order.
Just a question about procedurally. Are points of order is used to respond to another member's commentary? I think that's just what we're, my understanding is that the process is that we notify you that we would like to speak and we get on a list and then we wait our turn. I just want to make sure that I'm clear about that as I just want to be sure we're all on the same page.
Thank you, Representative Hansen. Members, please, when using points of order, cite the rule that you believe is being broken with the member's comments. I will take that under consideration when making a ruling. If I decide to rule on the point of order, I will rule on the point of order. And if I decide not to rule on the point of order, I will remind members to please keep your remarks confined to the topic before us, which is House File 3432. Thank you, Representative Hansen. Representative Liebling, you have the floor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this has to do with, we were talking about workers and bringing workers to Minnesota, which is very much the topic of the bill, which is, I think, why the representative went off on the topic of abortion, because I think the allegation was that if we didn't have abortion rights in Minnesota, that we would have more workers. And my point is that I do not think of women who have babies as factories to produce workers. I think this is something that individual people in Minnesota get to decide whether they want to have a child for whatever reason they want to have the child or not have the child. And as I made the point that it is not accurate to say that we ended reporting on that, we did not, and abortions are dropping in the state. But I think it's also important to note along these same lines, if the representative is concerned that we are somehow not valuing workers and children growing up in the state, that in this quick time, I haven't been able to fully research this, but I see data that says that we lose 400 to 500 people a year to gun violence in the state, and many of those are teens and people in their 20s. So if we're concerned about losing people from the workforce, I think looking at how to stem gun violence and keep alive people who are here, who want to be contributing, who are our children, that would be a good place to look. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Liebling. Further discussion to House File 3432. I recognize Chair Rarick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Wow, we have gone all over the board, haven't we, from abortion to gun violence to everything else. Let's talk about the bill. So I have great concerns that Representative Allen brought up and the fact that somebody could move here, with plans to work here and maybe work 1 month and have a pay stub for a month and then establish their family, their child could get in-state tuition and then leave. Or also, it doesn't seem like there's any floor as far as what kind of job you're coming here for, because it matters, because we've been talking about people coming to Mayo and Rochester and, you know, highly skilled, highly paid people. And that's fantastic. But here's the thing. It doesn't say that in the bill. It says things like, Anybody and anyone who gets a job offer comes here for any level of pay. So we could have very, very low paid people that don't contribute very much, and then they could turn around and leave after a month. So I see huge holes in this bill. And I believe the author said that we're literally trying to encourage people to come here. Well, We certainly have. The state of Minnesota has encouraged lots of people to come here. And Chair Robbins could attest to the massive level of fraud that we've now had because we've got so much compassion in our health and human services programs. We have all kinds of things like that. So I think we need to take a very close look at what we're actually doing. This bill actually is shifting costs to Minnesotans. We're encouraging people to come. Really, they could get paid very, very little and come and contribute very little. There is nothing in the bill to restrict that. They could come and work for a month and then leave. There's really no parameters around this at all. And I'm a little bit concerned, you know, Minn State and the University of Minnesota said, well, it's not really a big deal. But it could be, because the whole point of this is to encourage more people to move in and thus get in-state tuition, which in especially at the U, that's a huge difference. And it's a huge difference because in-state students were bearing a very heavy burden until the out-state, the non-in-state tuition people, that rate was raised. So I see many, many, many holes in this bill. I'm glad we're laying it over. We don't even have a fiscal note. I don't think that the fiscal note will clearly represent what's actually going to happen, though, because once you encourage people to come, especially if you start putting them on state grant programs, then you're really going to see people come. So you've got North Star Promise saying if you have a household income of $80,000 or less, college is free. If you include these people in that, now you're going to have a lot of people coming. So we already have a massive structural deficit that we've created. $102 million is not a small amount of money. So we've got big problems. I just see this as yet more problematic things of bigger problems that we need to fix. So glad we're laying this over, but it's got big problems as far as I can see.
Representative Ray Rauer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to highlight that every single worker is vital to our state and our economy. Every single job is important. Nothing was made it more clear than the pandemic that our farmers, our grocery store cashiers, our people shipping our food were the most important part of our economy because we couldn't have survived without them, still doing their jobs and putting themselves at risk. So I don't appreciate the comment that some jobs are more important than others. And with that said, Madam Chair, I would be very happy to work with you after this hearing. If you believe there is something that we could add to this bill, I don't think we can tie people to Minnesota and force them to stay here, but if there is something creative you can think of that would be an addition that could encourage them to stay, I would be very happy to consider that. And I just want to highlight one last time, this is not going to affect the state grant program. That's why we added the amendment.
All right. Thank you very much for your presentation, Representative Ray Rauer. With that, I will renew my motion that House File 3432 is amended, be laid over for possible inclusion. The bill is laid over. All right, members, the second and final bill on our calendar for today is House File 3411, which is being brought forward to us by Vice Chair Coulter. Vice Chair Coulter, as you're getting yourself settled in there, would you like to move that your bill be referred to the Judiciary Committee?
Excuse me. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I will make that motion.
All righty. Vice Chair Coulter, please tell us about your bill, House File 3411. Members all know that there is an author's amendment, but I will ask that the Vice Chair explain his bill. Once he's done with that, then we'll bring up the amendment. Vice Chair Coulter.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, members. And before I get into the bill, I do just want to say personally, Representative Rurick, it really is good to see you again. So members, we've talked a lot about storms in this committee. Last week, we talked about a storm that hit hard and suddenly, caused tremendous, expensive damage, but thankfully, no major injuries or deaths. It struck at the heart of one of our fine universities in Minnesota, and something central to its identity. This was a storm that was a natural storm. You could call it an act of God. The week before, we talked about a different kind of storm, one that also hit hard and very suddenly. That storm also caused tremendous, expensive damage. It caused countless serious injuries and the deaths of two Minnesotans. It struck at the heart of who we are as a state, and something central to our identity as a place that welcomes our neighbors. That storm, however, was unnatural. It was a cruel choice made by the Trump administration. It was an act of, in the president's own words, reckoning and retribution. House File 3411 is a response to that. And the stories that we have heard and will hear today from the people who live, work, and learn on our campuses. So I'd like to just briefly walk through what the bill does, and then we can get into the A4 amendment. Actually, you know what? I'm going to change my mind. On second thought, I think it's probably easier if we can do the A4 author amendment first, and then I can walk through the bill.
Absolutely, Vice Chair Coulter. Okay, members, as mentioned earlier, Vice Chair Coulter is bringing forward an author's amendment, which is labeled A4. I will move that the A4 author's amendment to put the bill in the form that the author so desires. Members, does everyone have a copy of the A4 amendment? All right. Vice Chair Coulter, please proceed with explaining to us the A4 amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I'm certainly happy to go into greater detail. In broad strokes, the A4 amendment just puts a little more meat on the bones. It clarifies some definitions, clarifies some language. I will just direct members' attention to the second page where it does add a subdivision 4, requiring more information from administration when students register, and subdivision 5 clarifies that this does not create a personal liability for folks working in good faith. So that is the amendment.
Members, is there any discussion to the A4 author's amendment? Representative Hicks.
Thank you so much. I just wanted to say thank you so much for adding that subdivision 4. Representative Coulter, I know there was some discussion in another committee that was a real pain point for folks. And so by having this in here, I think we avoid that concern and really make sure that we're protecting our students and making sure everyone has the information they need to stay safe.
Thank you, Representative Hicks. Is there any further discussion to the A4 author's amendment? Seeing none. Oh, Chair Rarick. Sorry, I've got to check the computer screen now. My apologies. Chair Rarick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I know. I'm sorry I've made this difficult, but I'm just recovering and feeling pretty good. But I have a question, Representative Coulter. So on line 2.3 of the A4, you've said paragraph 1 says required by state or federal law. So can you just give me more? What do you mean in that particular line?
Vice Chair Coulter.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Rarick. I guess I would say the line sort of speaks for itself that that any other sort of requirements that exist within law that this does not restrict federal agents acting in a legal way.
Chair Rarick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Okay, so as I understand the bill in totality, and maybe this is a part of it. I'm not quite sure, but right now in current law, any violation of law which includes crossing the border illegally, which is, you know, not a criminal, it's a civil matter, so to speak. But the with the changes of your bill, is it accurate to say that this starts, they can start to take action once they have been charged with a gross misdemeanor? And does that change have anything to do with line 2.3?
Vice Chair Coulter.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Rarick. I will confess I'm not an expert on that area of law, but perhaps one of our fine nonpartisan staffers can weigh in.
Mr. Hopkins.
Mr. Chair and members, so line 2.3 of the A4 amendment, I believe, is primarily meant to get at judicially issued search warrants. So if a federal immigration officer presents a judicially issued search warrant, they would be allowed to enter. Entry into the campus would be required by law, federal law if it's a federally issued search warrant, and state law if it's a search warrant issued by a state court judge.
Thank you, Mr. Hopkins. Representative Rarick, I believe you have the floor now.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Okay, so then it has to do with changing it from administrative warrant, which is what the federal ICE agents are able to do currently, to only a judicial warrant. Is that what this is, the net effect of this change on line 2.3? And it looks like then the change shifting it all the way up to a gross misdemeanor charge, which right now they could look for people that just crossed the border and don't have any charges. So if just to clarify one more time, so in line 2.3, this is getting to the part of changing from an administrative warrant, which is what they use currently, to only a judicial warrant. Is that correct?
Mr. Hopkins.
Mr. Chair and members, yes, that's correct. An administrative warrant does not require access under law. A school could still refuse a federal immigration agent's access to the campus if they presented an administrative warrant, but if they present a judicially issued search warrant, they could not refuse access under the bill or current Fourth Amendment law.
Representative Rarick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Okay, so I'm wondering if Representative Coulter could answer this question then. So currently they can use an administrative warrant to access campuses. And I think there's been just one maybe instance that I know of where they have arrested somebody in a parking lot. Maybe there's more. I'm sure we'll hear more. So when we get to the full bill, Representative Coulter, if you could explain the difference then of how we're going so that they could access the campus only if somebody has been charged with a gross misdemeanor. If you could kind of point that out. If it's not here, I'm trying to figure out where that change is effectively happening if it's not in this line. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Rarick. Vice Chair Coulter.
I don't have anything further to add.
Okay, sorry, I thought I saw you waving your hand there. All right, members, is there any further discussion to the A4 author's amendment? Representative Robbins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Representative Coulter, I was interested in the discussion in lines 1, 8, and again in 1, 11, and 12, where you say that the property is within the same reasonably contiguous geographic area of the institution. And in one instance, it's property owned or controlled by the post-secondary institution. And in another, it's owned by the institution but controlled by another person. So, A, what does reasonably contiguous geographic area mean? And what's the instance in which the property is owned by the institution but controlled by someone else?
Vice Chair Coulter.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm going to, Representative Robbins, I will start off by saying that this definition is pulled from the Clery Act, which is a federal law related to reporting of crimes on campus. To answer your second question first, that refers to spaces that are, I guess the term would be sort of leased by like a food vendor or something like that who operates on campus, but they operate within property that is still owned by the institution. And then to your first question, I think I'm going to have to rely on Mr. Hopkins again for how that is interpreted and so on.
Mr. Hopkins.
Mr. Chair and members, so yes, this definition of campus comes from the Federal Clery Act, which deals with crime reporting by post-secondary institutions. So in terms of how it would be administered by the institutions, they would administer it consistently with how they administer the Clery Act.
Vice Chair Coulter. Representative Robbins.
Thank you, Mr. Hopkins and Representative Coulter. So is there any case law or anything that defines reasonably contiguous geographic area?
Mr. Hopkins.
Mr. Chair, no, not that I'm aware of at this time.
Thank you.
Is there any further discussion to the A4 author's amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor of adopting the A4 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, please say no.
No.
The motion prevails and the A4 author's amendment is adopted. Members, we have another amendment in our packets, which is labeled DE1. Do all members have a copy of the DE1 amendment? All right, Representative Schwartz, am I correct that you're offering this amendment?
Correct.
Representative Schwartz, please explain the DE1 amendment.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, members. This amendment is just simple. It's just asking the state to give clear guidance to universities about how to handle the law enforcement on campus. Right now, schools don't always know what their rights and responsibilities are when the law enforcement show up on campus. So this might create some confusion for schools, officials, staff, and students. This amendment directs the OHE to publish clear guidance for colleges and universities in consultants with the Attorney General's office. The goal is to explain what laws actually says and how the school should respond to law enforcement take action on campus. The guidance must explain a few key things. First, it must explain the difference between different types of warrants, judicial warrants, and administrative warrants, and what counts as probable cause. Second, it must explain how the law applies to different parts of the campus that includes buildings, parking lots, and athletic facilities, and places where school activities are happening as well. Third, the guidance must clearly explain what law it is based on. That includes the U.S. Constitution, Minnesota law, and relevant to court decisions. To be clear, this amendment doesn't change the rules about law enforcement on campus. It simply requires the state to provide a clear information so colleges understand the law and can respond appropriately when law enforcement requests access to campus. Thank you, Chair. I ask for you guys' support on this amendment.
Thank you, Representative Schwartz. Members, discussion to the DE1 amendment. Vice Chair Coulter.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Schwartz, for bringing this forward. If I could ask, I know I'm not wild about asking members to yield in committee. That's, I think, something we do on the floor. I'm wondering, though, if Representative Schwartz, specifically on line 1.12, you refer to sort of different sources of law. I'm wondering if you could give some examples of what those sources of law might be.
Representative Schwartz.
Yes, Representative Coulter. So what I was looking at, I know when we talked about a few weeks ago, we're talking about federal immigration. Sorry, I'm losing my voice. Immigration agents, federal agents coming in. I know that there was confusion on that as far as federal being able to come on public state campus. That's what I was referring to.
Vice Chair Coulter.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Okay, I think I know what you're getting at here. What I will just say, I'm going to ask members to oppose this amendment respectfully, partly because it actually does much of what the author's amendment that we just adopted already does in terms of requiring institutions to provide more information, which I actually do think is a good thing. That's something we have heard from students and staff and faculty and administrators that there is a want of that kind of information. And I will tell you, this amendment actually includes some things that mine didn't, and I think that's always helpful. So when this bill gets to the Judiciary Committee, I'm happy to incorporate that into this bill as well. And I think to get at the question that I was asking, I think it is important because I think we know, we have seen ICE agents willingly violating the 1st, 4th, 5th, 6th, 8th, and 10th Amendments to the U.S. Constitution, as well as Article 1, Section 10 of the Constitution of the State of Minnesota. So I am, again, respectfully going to ask folks to vote no on the amendment.
Is there any further discussion to the DE1 amendment? Representative Rarick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate it. You're catching on. I appreciate it. I just wanted to ask for a roll call, Mr. Chair.
Representative Rarick has requested a roll call vote, and there will be a roll call on the vote for the DE1 amendment. Members, is there any further discussion to the DE1 amendment? Representative Novotny.
Thank you, Chair Wolgamott. I think this is a great compromise that we can actually get data. Representative Cleavorn talked about wanting to have data and actually making decisions based on facts. When we had the, whatever you call it, a couple weeks ago on this thing, we sat through nearly 2 hours of testimony on one-sided incidents. The one that was I was able to look up, the Augsburg incident, I was able to find some documentation on that that was provided by NPR, but other than that, we don't have any data and we're getting one-sided testimony. The one thing I noticed, and it was glossed over by many of the testifiers from the administrations that were here, was that we had one incident that they could point to that happened in the state from a traffic stop that was attempted on public street, and then the person fled onto the Augsburg property into a parking lot. So it'd be really good to know what we're trying to deal with. So much of the testimony that we had in that other hearing was, to me, to use your word, Representative Coulter, that you talk about cruel. I thought it was cruel that listening to the description of the students of how terrified they were, and they were terrified because they were whipped up into that frenzy. I give nothing but compliments to what the University of Minnesota did and how they handled it, as opposed to these other schools that took a non-factor and decided to make manufacture outrage and making their kids upset. Representative Liebling's probably old enough to remember, like I am, the War of the Worlds, where you know that false narrative was turned into a terrible incident that was all made up. We had one incident that was supposed to be on the street, and now we have a bill to create something, you know, to solve a problem that didn't exist. And I know, you know, give someone a whistle, put them on a corner, make them think they're making a difference, but that's time they could have been in class learning. It's one of the reasons why both of my kids went to school out of state. I won't name the university, but it's very, very close to where you live. And I remember my daughter who was walking through the education department, seeing the things that were posted on the doors at that, the professors and the teachers. And I saw just what was on the doors. And I thought, this institution is about indoctrination, not education. The next week we went to a different college in a different state, and I didn't see one thing on one door, not pro, not con, not red, not blue, not anything. And I got the feeling that my kid would be able to get an education and not an indoctrination. And if I took anything away from that nearly two-hour hearing that we had on this incident before, there was a lot of indoctrination going on. And for that, I recommend a yes vote on this, and that'll be all. Thank you.
Is there any further discussion to the DE1 amendment? I recognize Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And first of all, I hope that Representative Novotny is referring to the film, which I gather from the internet was 2005, because I think the original War of the Worlds was way before me. So I hope that's not a comment on my age, Mr. Chair. So, you know, be careful, Representative Novotny. So I did have a question for Vice Chair Coulter. Vice Chair Coulter, it's been, I know you discussed a little bit about the DE1, about what it does that duplicates what's in the underlying bill, but I just want to make sure for the public, you know, people don't know what DE this and that means, so I just want to make sure people understand. The amendment before us replaces the bill, so it wipes out some stuff that's in your bill. It may duplicate some stuff that's in here, but it wipes out a lot of what's in the bill, and I wonder if you could tell us, what is this amendment getting rid of that's in your bill, so that when we all vote on it, people understand what we're voting to get rid of. Thank you.
Vice Chair Coulter.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Liebing, for that question. And I had expected that I would explain the bill before we got to the DE, and I didn't spell that out specifically, so thank you for that. Yeah, for the dozens of people watching at home, DE stands for delete everything. So the DE amendments delete everything and then insert new language. And so I'm happy to walk through the bill at this point and explain what this amendment would delete. So within the bill, Section 1 would require that student data not be released absent a judicial order or subpoena if it is for immigration enforcement. And I will point out that this is an option that already exists for schools under federal law, under FERPA. This would just take away that option. Section two, says that schools cannot designate data related to nationality or immigration status as directory information data. Section three is really sort of the meat of the bill. Specifies that employees may not consent to ICE, CBP, or any other federal immigration officers entering campus without identification, statement of purpose, and a judicial warrant. Specifies that employees must notify administration and that they must limit the activities of those agents to only the places, times, and individuals listed on the warrant. So as has been mentioned, the A4 amendment did add in a subdivision 4 that is similar to the DE amendment, but the DE amendment would delete all of that in addition to subdivision 5, which was just added, that would not create any personal liability for anyone acting in good faith.
All righty, Representative Liebling, anything further? All right, well, before we get on to any more discussion on the bill, I will ask if there's discussion related to the DE1 amendment. I see, I recognize Representative Hansen.
Thank you. I first have a question. I feel like I've learned anytime we ask a office or agency to do anything, there's usually a fiscal note. So I would imagine that this would alter the fiscal note we have, which represents virtually, from what I'm seeing, zero. But I'm wondering if we can get confirmation if we know how much this will cost the office, if there's an estimate, will they need any new FTEs? How often would they have to be providing this guidance? Is it, do they have to provide the guidance by hosting a seminar on campus? Are they providing this guidance, you know, which way? I guess like that's related to the fiscal note because it would impact it. Like how is this guidance being given and would it impact that fiscal note?
Representative Schwartz.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Representative Hansen. I was thinking more along the lines of training as far as keep, how should I say, training, educational training like we all have here. That's quite normal in most jobs nowadays. I figured that would be suffice.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Chair. And have you checked in if there's a fiscal note, what that training would cost? And are you imagining that these would be trainings on each campus? Are we expecting university staff to travel to St. Paul from wherever they are at to receive the training? Is it going to be on one day? Are there lots of days? I just want to make sure I understand. I'm just trying to imagine like what the fiscal note would look like. That's why I'm asking those questions.
Representative Schwartz.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Representative Hansen. You know, that's why I wanted to work with OHE on this to see what guidelines we could provide. You know, originally my thoughts when is when I decided to write this amendment a few weeks ago, when we did hear from different schools specifically about, you know, different law enforcement coming to campus. And we were just simply asking during that time if universities were cooperating with campuses. And I just wanted to just kind of give them a clear vision, like, yes, if this happens, then we do step one, step two, step three. That's where my amendment came from, really in a place of guidance, really, just to help clarify and not kind of bring down the rhetoric and not scare the students, and that way they can continue to go to classes.
So Representative Hansen. Yeah.
Thank you, and thank you for the answer. I appreciate that. I think that we don't need to create a false choice of choosing, so I hear you and would ask that you would potentially consider adding this to Representative Coulter's bill as opposed to deleting everything, because I think we can do both. I think we can both make sure our students know that campus is going to follow the law and, you know, look for those judicial warrants and so on and so forth, and also you know, have OHIGA offer some training. I do think it would alter this fiscal note, depending on, again, what that training ends up looking like. So I do think that would make this have a cost. My second question is, I've worked with a lot of law students and law schools and some of the stuff that I've done, and I, you know, I'm not a lawyer, and I will never, don't want to be one, would never be one, and I love my lawyer friends, but they get a little touchy when you try to explain the law to them. So I'm wondering if we can potentially, you know, if this amendment were to be accepted, could we exempt law schools as to not insult these very prestigious institutions that are way smarter than I think most of the folks in this room who don't have law degrees, or especially those that are educating our next generation of lawyers. We have people from around the country that come to our law schools, and I think they are probably very capable of figuring this out and educating their institutions on this too.
Representative Schwartz.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Rep. Henson. Again, this isn't to re-educate the lawyers. It isn't to it's just to give an explanation of the difference between the different warrants and the different different law enforcement if they happen to come to campus.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Chair. I will leave that discussion to you to have with lawyers and Representative Schwartz, because I do not want to have that conversation with any of my lawyer friends who would definitely see that as kind of explaining the law to them. I think it says guidance, right? And so providing this guidance, I think, to a law school, they would likely argue back about what that guidance is, and it would probably be a lot longer than just one little training. So I won't be supporting this. I think it would be fine if it was, you know, in addition to what we're doing, because I don't believe in creating false choices, especially in public policy making like this. And so I think that's because you're looking to erase work that's already been done and information that is supported by a lot of our students and people I've heard from. And as I've shared in this committee, my community was devastated by what I said. It wasn't manufactured. It wasn't just us stirring something up. It was in my neighborhood, in my community that I saw firsthand. And so it's not fake. And, you know, I don't think that by educating people about the Constitution, Representative Novotny, we're not indoctrinating people if we're telling them what their rights are. I mean, we all respect the Constitution, and I think it's great that we teach our kids and students what that is. So I think that, you know, this is not ready for prime time, and I think we should bring it back and potentially consider adding it rather than just trying to erase all of Representative Coulter's work. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Hansen. Further discussion to the DE1 amendment, Representative Robbins.
Very quickly, Mr. Chair, I just wanted to point out for the record that in the underlying as amended original bill, Representative Coulter asked the Commissioner of Higher Education in consultation with the Attorney General to develop standardized language that a post-secondary institution may use to meet the requirements of the bill. Fiscal note, zero. The DE or the amendment by Representative Schwartz says the Commissioner of Higher Ed must, in consultation with the Attorney General, issue guidance regarding the institution's rights and responsibilities. So I'm assuming the fiscal note will be similar. They're both asking OHI to come up with guidance and consultation with the Attorney General. So I don't think we have to worry about the fiscal note cost of the Schwartz amendment. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Further discussion, Representative Hansen.
Thank you. I just wanted to also clarify for the record that I saw that as well. I read that piece in the bill. And my question was, again, to understand better what Representative Schwartz's idea was about how that would be delivered. And as we heard, it's like a training. And so my questions remain open about, is this a training on each campus? Are we going to them? Is the AG going there? I mean, mileage, nothing else, you know, would have some money there. So that was the reason for it, but I very clearly see what was listed in the bill. Just wanted to make sure that I understood what the impression was for what kind of training, to make sure campuses are ready to do that and see if they had any opinions about what that training would look like. Just trying to stay in conversation with them. Thanks.
All right, members, we are going to, for the sake of time, move to a vote on this bill. But before doing that, Representative Schwartz, if you have any closing remarks for your amendment.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Rarick.
Thank you. Really quickly to that point, Mr. Chair. So in Representative Coulter's amendment that we adopted on line 2.8, it is a whole long section added and further down of information to students. And so there in his amendment that he just added, there's a whole section of what the institutions now have to inform their students. And again, that fiscal note was zero. So I think the fiscal note question on this is kind of a moot point. So I just want to say that and thank you very much. And we'll go to a vote now.
Representative Schwartz.
Yeah, my amendment was to provide clarity and consistency for a higher education institution. That's all I was trying to do with this amendment. Thank you.
The clerk will take the roll on the DE1 amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Chair Wolgamott.
No.
Wolgamott votes no. Chair Robbins.
Aye.
Robbins votes aye. Vice Chair Coulter.
No.
Coulter votes no. Vice Chair Schwartz.
Aye.
Schwartz votes aye. Representative Allen.
Aye.
Allen votes aye. Representative Duran.
Aye.
Duran votes aye. Representative Hansen.
No.
Hansen votes no. Representative Hicks.
No.
Hicks votes no. Representative Cleavorn.
Cleavorn votes no.
Excuse me. Representative Cleavorn, no. Is that correct? Thank you. Representative Liebling.
Liebling, no.
Liebling, no. Representative Noor.
Noor, no.
Noor, no. Representative Novotny. Novotny, yes. Representative Rarick.
Yes.
Rarick, yes. Representative Scott.
Yes.
All right. We have 7 ayes and 7 nays.
There being 7 ayes and 7 nays, the motion does not prevail and the DE1 amendment is not adopted. All right. Vice Chair Coulter, to your underlying bill, as amended, we are going to make sure that we hear from testifiers. So if our first testifier would please make their way to the table. We have Jenna Chernega, the IFO president, and Winona from Winona State Sociology faculty.
Mr. Chair, if I could just briefly finish again, because we took things a little bit out of order than the way I was expecting. If I could just briefly finish my opening, I promise I'll be brief. I know we're short on time here.
Vice Chair Coulter, please proceed with the explanation of your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I did explain what the bill does. I wanted to just be very sort of clear about what the bill does not do. It does not ban ICE from college campuses. That is not within our authority. It does not regulate public places that are not controlled by the college or university. It does not force a confrontation between faculty or staff or administrators and ICE. No offense to the adjunct communications instructors in the room, but we don't want them staring down a phalanx of ICE agents. It does not address the very real economic and financial devastation that we know many of our students have faced. And it does not, unfortunately, guarantee a freedom from fear. I wish there were something that we could do that would guarantee that, but I know there is not. And ultimately what this bill is getting after is that the most important thing that happens at a school, any school, is learning. Our job is to protect that learning and the people who are learning and the people who make it happen. I have been thinking a lot about the way that President Pribunau closed his remarks. He said, education is resistance. Not to any political party or administration, but to the forces of dehumanization, violence, and injustice wherever they are deployed.
Thank you for that, Vice Chair Coulter. All right, Ms. Chernega, please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Yes, my name is Jenna Chernega. I am here in my capacity as president of the IFO. We represent the faculty, coaches, counselors, and librarians across our 7 Minnesota State Universities. Thank you so much for the opportunity to speak today in favor of Representative Coulter's legislation. As you heard in the previous conversation, higher education and students getting through their higher education is critical to the economy and workforce of this state. And as you may know, the federal government had a sensitive location protection on the books for about 30 years. That protection was revoked last January. Its existence was especially important for public universities and colleges because our campuses are largely public property. That is, unlike private colleges and universities, we cannot ban the public from coming into our parking lots, green spaces, or classroom buildings. The only locations on public university campuses that are deemed private and therefore off limits to the public or to law enforcement without a judicial warrant are residence halls, offices, and classrooms while class is in session. Under the sensitive location protection of the federal government, immigration agents were not typically supposed to engage in enforcement activities on campus or near campus buildings. This allowed free passage of students, faculty, and staff from one building to another without fear of immigration enforcement activities taking place. When the sensitive location protection was revoked in January of 2025, faculty members in the IFO were acutely aware of what the change meant. Immediately, the tensions and stress on campuses shot up and led to the enormous emotional and workload burden that I testified to a couple of weeks ago. Just as a reminder, 94% of the faculty surveyed reported students expressing extreme stress or safety concerns regarding immigration enforcement on or near campus. 91% of faculty reported the same level of distress amongst their colleagues. And 48% of surveyed faculty reported a significant increase in workload due to this crisis. And the need to rewrite curriculum, move classes online, canceling field trips simply because of the risk of encountering enforcement agents. Without the protection, students are at risk when walking from their dorm rooms to their classrooms, from one classroom building to another, when walking to a dining hall to use their meal plan, or walking to their car in the parking lot. Given the apparently high proportion of ICE detentions of legal residents and even U.S. citizens, student fears about ICE activity are not overblown, even if they are legally in the U.S. studying on a J visa or other status. I truly believe that a sensitive location provision in Minnesota, like the one proposed by Representative Coulter, would restore some sense of safety and security on our campuses, even if it would not entirely alleviate fears. The ICE occupation in Minnesota has been incredibly disruptive to higher education, as it has been to almost every sector of our state. This bill would ease that disruption on our campuses and allow students to continue their educations, something that is crucial to Minnesota, to ensure that we have workers to fill the necessary positions in our state. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Next up, we have John Beeler from the ACLU Policy Council. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Chair Wolgamott, members of the committee. My name is John Beeler. I'm the Policy Counsel with the ACLU of Minnesota. Testifying today in support of HF 3411 as amended, this bill returns us to a policy that was in place for several decades, prohibiting immigration enforcement in sensitive locations. In 2007, the George W. Bush administration issued a memo to ICE restricting immigration enforcement, quote, at or near schools or other institutions of education and venues where their children and families may be present. Presidents Obama, Trump, and Biden continued or expanded this policy only for President Trump to revoke the policy on the first day of his second term. As prior DHS officials noted, DHS can accomplish its enforcement mission without denying or limiting individuals' access to needed medical care, children access to their schools, the displaced access to food and shelter, and people of faith access to their places of worship, and more. This policy included colleges, universities, vocational, and trade schools. A federal change last year makes this bill necessary. Although, according to the federal government, Operation Metro Surge has ended, there remain between 600 and 650 immigration agents present in the state of Minnesota, depending on a court declaration or the testimony of former Secretary Noem, depending on which one is more accurate. And that does not include local officers who've been delegated under the federal government's 287G program who are authorized to do civil immigration enforcement around the state. Bills protecting sensitive locations have existed in other states for nearly a decade. When a similar bill was challenged in California, the court upheld the state's restrictions. Citing Supreme Court precedent, the Ninth Circuit noted that a state does not discriminate against the federal government and those with whom it deals unless it treats someone better than it treats them. And the California law did not treat federal government worse than anyone else. Indeed, it did not regulate federal operations at all. Similarly, this bill does not regulate federal operations. It only governs the activities of employees of post-secondary institutions. And one point on the guidance on warrants, the Attorney General for the state issued guidance on May 1st, 2025, last year, on responding to ICE activities, including judicial and administrative warrants. Part of what he put in there is an administrative warrant is not issued by a court and does not allow ICE to enter non-public areas without permission. An organization is not required to allow ICE to enter non-public areas on the basis of an administrative warrant alone. That was universally agreed to be the understanding of administrative warrants as of the time of that writing. However, leaked from a whistleblower at ICE, that policy was changed internally in November, where DHS decided that its agencies did have the power to issue administrative warrants, broadening or restricting the protections afforded by the Fourth Amendment. And that's not how this Constitution operates. Executive agencies are not allowed to redefine key terms in the Constitution to fit their prerogatives. We expect that provision to be litigated, but it makes this provision all the more important that we provide these state protections, the clarity between judicial warrants and administrative warrants, at least until a court steps in and tells DHS, or reminds DHS the importance of judicial enforcement of those warrants. Thank you. Please support the bill.
Thank you for your testimony. Our next testifier is Will Luther, the Director of State Affairs for the Undergraduate Student Government. Mr. Luther, welcome back to the Higher Education Committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Yeah, thank you, Chair, members of this committee. I am William Luther. I'm the Director of State Affairs for the Undergrad Student Government. I'm currently a junior at the University of Minnesota Twin Cities College of Liberal Arts. And I'm here in support of House File 3411, which establishes statutory requirements for universities and colleges to protect students' safety and their individual rights. What we saw this winter was unprecedented, where thousands of Minnesotans were swept away, often without proper due process, regardless of citizenship or immigration status. During Operation Metro Surge, we saw this tragic passing of two Minnesotans at the hands of members of the Department of Homeland Security. As students returned to class in this environment, it created unprecedented fear on our campus. Students were worried about leaving their dorms, apartments, and homes. They get to class, they get to student centers, they get to meet up with fellow students. As you heard in this committee, a little over a week ago, students have had family members taken, and many worried that they could be next. The main question on many students' minds was, if I go to class, or if I go back to living on campus, will my university protect my rights? House File 3411 would provide the needed statutory guidance for universities and colleges on how they should deal with federal immigration enforcement. Students would know what their university will know that their university will protect their right to an education without the fear of being swept up by a mass, uncoordinated immigration action. One thing about the bill is clear. It does not tell universities to obstruct lawful immigration enforcement. It simply requires colleges and universities to never let immigration officials into campus buildings without a proper, lawful, judicial warrant. If a targeted immigration investigation does its due diligence, this shouldn't pose a stringent barrier to the Department of Homeland Security in doing its work legally. This bill protects students and prioritizes their safety so they can learn in an environment free of fear. I want to thank you, Representative Coulter, for bringing this bill in this committee, and I urge this committee to vote aye on this bill. Thank you.
Thank you so much for your testimony, Mr. Luther. All right, our next testifier is Hans Hicks, a student joining us from Metro State. Mr. Hicks, welcome to the Higher Education Committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Chair Wogamont and Chair Robbins. My name is Hans Hicks, and I'm the legislative fellow at Students United, the voice for all four-year students enrolled in the Minnesota State University system. And I'm here today to talk about the impact of increased federal immigration enforcement on campuses across the Minnesota State system, and voice our support for HF 3411. ICE has created an environment of fear and paranoia on campuses across the state, and that changes student behavior on and off the college campus. I am at Metro State, where foot traffic and utilization of student services is down, including our food shelves. In the Metro, American citizens feel unease going to and from campus if they believe they belong to a potentially targeted demographic. I know some students who rely on public transit that now take care to avoid critical transfer points as ICE abductions have occurred at those locations, increasing their commute time to class. At Minnesota State University Mankato on Thursday, January 15th, reports of plainclothes agents going from campus housing complex to housing complex, demanding papers, knocking on doors, and harassing both students and community members. One student was detained at their apartment by ICE in spring of 2025 in front of parents, and later released, only to be detained in front of their parents once again in early 2026. While immigration enforcement actions directly target certain populations, the broader impact spreads across the entire campus environment. Faculty have reported enforcement activity has fundamentally altered classroom dynamics and the ability of students to focus on learning. In this way, policies that allow enforcement activities on and near campus reduce educational access for both immigrants and domestic students. These actions also affect enrollment. At Minneapolis College, according to the Star Tribune, new student enrollment dropped 16% this semester after three consecutive years of enrollment growth. At the Mankato State Office for Student Affairs and Enrollment Management, they report international and student enrollment has declined significantly due to the overall climate, and Operation Metro Surge is in part to blame for this climate. International student enrollment is an important revenue stream for all Minnesota State schools. Without it, significant budget cuts would limit opportunities for all students. All students deserve to feel safe on campus, and I'm here to tell you we do not feel safe. This is why we support Representative Coulter's bill to limit federal immigration officers' access to Minnesota post-secondary institutions. The legislature must ensure that college and universities remain safe and accessible learning environments where all students can attend class, seek advising, and participate in campus life without fear of immigration enforcement disrupting their education. Thank you for your time and your service to our state.
Thank you very much for your testimony, Mr. Hicks. Members, I'm going to extend our committee time by 5 minutes today if we need that to have the opportunity for members' questions. All right, apparently we can only extend it for 3 minutes, so those crucial 2 minutes, we'll just have to make the most of our time. Excuse me, 3 minutes. All right, member discussion to the bill as amended. Representative Allen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll make this real quick. Getting back to some of the fiscal concerns about the bill itself, what do you think is the training what the training cost is going to be? What kind of training cost is going to be imposed on higher education institutions already knowing the budgetary pressures they're under?
Vice Chair Coulter.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Allen. We have a fiscal note that is zero, so the best answer I can give based on that is zero.
Representative Allen.
Well, I did see the fiscal note, which I don't think it necessarily dives into really what the concern is with this. Universities are going to need to train staff, create new procedures, handle compliance issues, to verify warrants, documentation of law enforcement interactions. That's also going to create additional administrative costs. Institutions will also need to develop internal protocols for responding to federal officers, tracking requests for campus access. This is also going to require additional legal guidance, staff training, and administrative oversight. And I guess, have you fully considered the operational burden this is going to put in terms of policy and, like I said, burden on these colleges and universities?
Vice Chair Coulter.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Allen. I have had numerous conversations with folks at Minn State and the University of Minnesota, and they have not expressed any concerns to me.
Representative Allen.
And that's kind of my biggest concern about this entire thing. We always know that training leads to cost, especially in this particular case. So wouldn't you agree, Representative Coulter, that this is going to increase cost to, or the it's going to increase cost to the universities and colleges that are going to have to try to implement this?
Vice Chair Coulter.
Well, Mr. Chair and Representative Allen, again, the folks at the universities are saying that it will not. That's, I'm not a university administrator, so I can't speak any more to it than that.
Representative Allen. All righty, Representative Duran.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Coulter, would this bill stop the cooperation from, I guess, if ICE is in a pursuit of an individual that runs onto the campus, would that stop the maybe teachers or professors or students from helping out law enforcement from an action that's kind of leading onto the campus?
Vice Chair Coulter.
If that officer has a signed judicial warrant, no.
Representative Duran.
So they're in their legal duty of trying to catch a fleeing, probably maybe a fleeing felon, onto a campus, and you are now going to tell people that they are not allowed to cooperate law enforcement? Does this worry you about the Supremacy Clause at all?
Vice Chair Coulter.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So if they are pursuing a felon and have a warrant for the arrest of a felon, it would not, then they would be fine. This bill, again, this bill does not regulate the actions of ICE agents. It regulates the actions of people on campus.
Members, we've got about 2 minutes left, and I want to make sure to give Chair Rarick the chance to close things out for her side. So, Representative Duran, if you could be very brief.
I see very, very big concerns with this, and maybe the safety of the people on campus when you're not willing to have maybe the conversations, the cooperation with people that might lead to issues on your campus that have been off campus. I would expect that we would think about this, and now you're putting other people in danger because now you're not going to have them cooperate with people that might be in jeopardy from someone else who runs on campus. What if someone is fleeing and hits a peace officer with a car? They just now turned into a felon but do not have a warrant signed for them. So you now are going to hinder a federal investigation because now you're going to have people trying to hide this individual on your campus. Does this now turn your campus or the campuses, the state of Minnesota, into a sanctuary campus?
Vice Chair Coulter.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This bill does not require anybody to hide anybody. It does, beyond the actions listed in the bill that you have in front of you, it does not require anybody to do anything.
Representative Duran.
I'm good.
I recognize Chair Rarick.
Thank you, Chair Wilkemont. Just really quickly, you know, we all swore an oath to the Constitution, and I know we all love the Constitution dearly, and my concern is squarely, is this even constitutional? Are we even able as a state to regulate what federal officers do or don't do? I also have a concern that now we're requiring a judicial warrant. They can't use an administrative warrant. As Representative Coulter just said, if they're pursuing a felon, then it's fine. Well, the reality is, I believe, from reading the language of the bill, that if someone's been charged with a gross misdemeanor or above, which are incredibly violent and terrible crimes against people and other things as well, then they can pursue. But who they cannot pursue with an administrative warrant is anybody. And also, it's lowering, I mean, all of those lower crimes and fraud and other things, any a petty misdemeanor, a misdemeanor, any of those things, if they're being charged with any of those things, in addition to being in the country illegally, you cannot pursue. So I have really big concerns with this, and I don't know, I think we're out of time, so I'll stop talking. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Chair Rarick. Vice Chair Coulter.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just briefly, Representative Duran, to your comment, existing law already in the case of an emergency, like some kind of injury or something like that, would allow folks to move on campus. I want to again reiterate, this does not This does not regulate the actions of federal agents, period. Mr. Chair, we are running out of time here, so I will get moved to my closing. Could I request a roll call, please?
Yes, Vice Chair Coulter requests a roll call vote, and there will be a roll call. Vice Chair Coulter.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, members, for really what has been a thoughtful discussion. In my comments earlier, I mentioned that the most important job we as the Higher Education Committee have is to protect the people at our colleges that are learning and the people who support that learning. And I was thinking as I was driving in, as a parent, I've never dropped a child off at college, but I have dropped a child off at kindergarten. And in fact, I'm going to do that again this fall. And I'm given to understand that the emotions are pretty similar. You want them to learn, you want them to have fun, you want them to make friends, you hope they eat right, you want them to feel safe. And more importantly, you want them to be safe. This bill uses the power that we have to keep everyone who sets foot on a college campus safe. Thank you.
Vice Chair Coulter renews his motion that House File 3411, as amended, be referred to the Judiciary Committee. The clerk will take the roll on the bill, as amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Chair Wolgamott.
Wolgamott votes aye.
Chair Robbins, Wolgamott aye. Chair Robbins.
No.
Robbins, no. Vice Chair Coulter.
Aye.
Thought so. Vice Chair Schwartz.
No.
Representative Allen.
Allen votes no.
Allen, no. Representative Duran.
No.
Duran, no. Representative Hansen.
Aye.
Hansen, aye. Representative Hicks.
Aye.
Hicks, aye. Representative Cleavorn.
Cleavorn, aye.
Cleavorn, aye. Representative Liebling.
Aye.
Liebling, aye. Representative Noor.
Absolutely yes.
Noor, absolutely yes. Representative Novotny.
100% no.
Novotny, 100% no. Representative Rarick.
No.
Rarick, no. Representative Scott.
No.
Scott, no. Mr. Chair, we have 7 ayes and 7 nays.
There being 7 ayes and 7 nays, the motion does not prevail. Members, this meeting is adjourned.